The following program is part of the Inner Circle Podcasting Group. Go to innercirclecomics.com for more high-quality podcasts.
Doom Patrol. Negative Man. Elastigirl. Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Caldell.
Your beloved patrol is doomed.
You're listening to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast for people who miss the book by people who miss the book.
Yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at avantgarve. You can also contact us on waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can contact us on our Facebook page, on our Tumblr page, and all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and podbean.com. And we're also members of the Inner Circle Comics Podcasting Network, which you can find at innercirclecomics.com.
I'm Paul. You can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks. And we have a show Twitter account, which is alive and will talk to you. And it's called Wilfred. And that's at WFDPod.
Hi, Wilfred. He invaded Facebook this week and was a bit nasty when he put the question of the week up there. He's spreading like wildfire. Anyway, this week on the show, we are looking at Doom Patrol Volume 2, Number 9.
Just a single issue.
Just a single issue, but there are two stories in there. So it's one book with twice a story, sort of.
Wow.
Yes. But before we get to that, Paul, how's your week been?
My week in comics was all about Justice League United number 14, Mike.
Was it? Imagine that. What do you think of it?
Well, this is Jeff Parker's second part of his arc, which features Robot Man.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Robot Man in it. There was Cliff Steele teaming up with Steele.
Yes.
John Henry Irons for a bit of action. And they found themselves face-to-face with the Creature Commandos in a time-displaced sort of story with World War II and World War I all sort of blending together and a bit of future stuff as well. So there were some very cool moments. Throughout, weren't there?
Mm, it was.
What did you think of it, Mike?
I really enjoyed the scene where he literally disarmed another robot. You know, it was a limb falling off a robot other than Cliff for a change, which was a nice touch. But yeah, the Creature Commandos making an appearance and all this other, as you say, time displaced World War II wackiness and hijinks. I really enjoyed it. I'm really sad that the series is wrapping up.
And there's a bit where Steel's flying with Robot Man magnetized to his back because Robot Man got knocked unconscious in the previous issue. And then they get blasted out of the sky. So Steel's unconscious and Robot Man saves him by making his arm stretch out. And you know what that reminded me of?
What's that?
There's a children's TV show that my kids were fairly fond of when they were really young called Little Robots, and some of the robots had stretchy arms exactly like that.
Right.
So it reminded me of that. Do you remember Little Robots?
No, a bit after my time.
Oh, it was a great show.
Was it? I must have.
British show.
Right.
They had a great theme song. Tiny, stretchy, sporty, Flappy the Bat.
Right.
Things like, someone out there knows it, I hope.
Well, the stretchy arm was a nice surprise. It actually reminded me of the Showcase Presents issues where Cliff had the different body that Kupperberg introduced
in that
3-issue 70s run. So I thought...
Yeah, the segmented arms.
Yeah. So I thought that was I'm hoping that was a throwback to that. It was a nice touch anyway to see Cliff doing something different for a change and not losing any limbs.
Were there any other comics in your week that you worth talking about?
My week, Swords of Sorrow finally wrapped up with its sixth and final issue. So that was good. Star Wars Shattered Empire was a lot of fun. The final issue of Miss Marvel, when the whole Secret Wars stuff, you know, basically ends the world there and then. What else was there? Batman and Robin Eternal, number 2. That was cool. I'm enjoying that, even though it's only the second issue. And Twilight Children from Darwin Cook and Gabriel Hernandez. God, I hope I've got that name right because I'm just pulling it out of my head.
Gilbert
Hernandez.
Gilbert.
There we go. I was testing you. You passed with flying colors. Well done. Let's move on. Yeah, that was a really interesting first issue and gorgeous Darwin Cook stuff as always. So it was an okay week. Yeah, it's things ended, things started as comics do. So it was okay. And JLU 14, of course, that was a lot of fun. So yeah, it was an okay week.
Yeah, survived the avalanche of Marvel titles, not Marvel number ones.
Yeah, again, mainly due to cost issues with, I think Doctor Strange was going to be like a $9 book at my store, so.
Wow, does it come with a lap dance? Or?
I don't know. I didn't look into it further. So I might trade weight for some of the newer Marvel stuff, maybe.
Oh, Mike.
Hey. Don't get
you
too excited.
You grew a little bit inside just then.
Grew or died. It's whenever I have to venture too close to trade waiting or digital reading, a part of me dies a little bit.
Trades are magnificent.
They're good. Yes, they have their place, but I can't completely jump all the way into trades. Not yet.
Right.
Maybe one day, maybe never. We'll see.
That sounds like a ticking I'm hearing in the background.
Hey, it is. That can only mean it's the Doom Clock. Okay, so looking at the face of the Doom Clock again, unsurprisingly, not a lot of change. We can see that the last book we had was issue 22 of volume 5, which was the Giffen Clark run. Cover dated July 2011, and that went on sale May 4th that same year. So it's been 4 years and 24 weeks since our last Doom Patrol book.
Gosh.
And even more depressing, the DC solicits for January came out today. No sign of them. No nothing. You know?
There was no Doom Patrol at all.
No, not at all.
Not a hint.
Not a hint. Not a tease. Not a nothing. We see you, DC Comics. We see you. The last appearance of the team, however, was in two different comic books, and that was only 10 weeks ago. All-Star Section 8, number 3, had a cameo of the team in the background of a large meeting of all Justice League type heroes. And Justice League United, number 12, had a one-panel appearance of the team as Stargirl was talking Robot Man into joining her team for the JLU's next mission. And yes, I hope everyone went out and bought JLU 14 this week. Because if not,
wow.
For shame. 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 Dong. Wow, that was a really
shaming
pathetic
some of the audience.
Yeah. I think we just lost some of them there. This week in Doom Patrol history, though, on sale for 12 cents on October 20 in 1966, with the cover date of December 66, was issue 108 of Volume 1 by Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani. This issue, titled Kid Disaster, sees Mento rescuing Elastigirl from the clutches of the King of the Microworld. Because apparently she got shrunk down to microscopic levels. And there was a whole other world there. And the king fell in love with Rita. Who could blame him? But then, as he rescues her, of course, who should show up but the Brotherhood of Evil? And Mento, Elastigirl, Robot Man, and Negative Man all fall foul of the team. So who does the chief send in to rescue them? Beast Boy.
Makes a change from Mento.
Yeah, well. But by the time Beast Boy arrives to find the team, it appears that they are dead. Dearie me. And my research shows me that story went over quite a few issues as well. It all sort of continued quite neatly and consecutively because the issue before got Rita and Mento into the micro world, and then, I think it went for like maybe half a dozen issues, this continuous storyline, which was awesome back then. But yes, that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
This week on Doomsplaining, we're looking at Doom Patrol number 9 from Volume 2, which was cover dated June 1988, but actually came out on the 23rd of February 1988. It has a cover price of 75 cents.
Whoa.
Which they were 75 cents these days.
God.
Page count. 48 pages.
75 cents for 48 pages. That's like hen's teeth.
Yeah. It's written by Paul Kupperberg. It's penciled by Eric Larson with the inker Gary Martin. All the letters were done by John E. Workman Jr. Colorist was Carl Gafford. And it sports an excellent cover by Eric Larson with Al Gordon on the inks, which shows the Doom Patrol in pitch battle with plastic men of several hues.
They sound familiar.
Yeah, who do the plastic men work for?
Racking my brain, dude. It'll come to me. Sure.
It'll come to us. Okay, so this story opens with two working schmoes in a missile base. And what's the rule in a comic? When you see a missile base, what happens? It gets attacked.
Yes.
And they're talking about how boring their job is when suddenly there's a blinding light. And from the light, all these figures come dropping down on them. And they're plastic men. And the story is called It's Raining Plastic Men, just to make the point stronger. And we see that there are blue plastic men, there are pink ones, and there are yellow ones. And they all seem to have a standard design based on their color. And they start trashing the base and breaking in. And they soon force open the silos and zap up the missiles, which get absorbed into the sky in a tractor beam. Mm. And the two working schmoes who work there look at all the rubble and wreckage at the end and say, I hope we don't have to pay for this. Then we cut to Kansas City, which is the home of the Doom Patrol. And the Doom Patrol are in their headquarters, but outside there is a mob protesting. So we've seen the start of this story before, and we actually know where it's going because we covered things out of order.
Mm-hmm.
that's the way we roll.
That's right.
And we see that Arani is in a hospital bed. Well, not a hospital bed, a bed inside the Doom Patrol headquarters, where Josh is attending to her in his physician mode. And, yeah, she's recovering from her injuries when shrapnel sliced her up. So in the last issue, which I didn't really notice being that significant, but apparently it's made her bedridden. And what's Arani talking about? She's talking about finding Niles Calder.
Oh, what? Again?
Yeah. And that ticks off Josh because he's, you know, that's all she ever goes on about it. And he said, time you faced it, he's dead. And she, you know, she does a lot of shouting and they shout back at each other. And then he realizes that he's actually trying to care for her and all the shouting's probably isn't good. So he makes his exit, something he should have done earlier. Then we see Larry, the former negative man without the negative energy at the moment, because Val Vostok, negative woman, is now the custodian of the negative energy.
Mm-hmm.
He's moping and he's looking at the crowd protesting outside and thinking, yeah, they've got the right idea about us. We suck. he's having a pity party.
Ever since he came back, Larry's been a real downer.
He's a total downer.
Yeah.
Someone should call the Wambulance for him. That's all he ever does.
Harsh anyway. But fair, yeah.
Yes, so Cliff steps in to see how he's doing, and pretty soon, within a couple of sentences, is regretting it, because he's just, everything sucks, I used to have the negative energy, now I don't. And he's complaining about how weak he is. And Cliff is not a counsellor, so he basically says, all right, call me if you need me. And walks out. And then Josh and Cliff bump into each other in the halls and talk about how it really sucks with those miserable people on the team. Mm. Anyway, then we see that some military types in Washington, D.C. are looking at this picture of the plastic men attacking the missile base, and they cleverly decide to share this by slipping it in a newspaper. And hopefully that will get the right attention from someone who will go and do their job for them.
Oh.
Mm. And then we, halfway down that page, we see it's now in the newspaper with the headline, Mystery Men Attack in New Mexico. And it's Karma's reading this.
Wayne. Wayne the punk.
And he's saying, boring, this is really boring. And he drops the paper down on the table. And then he's inner monologuing about how he hates being with the Doom Patrol, but he can't leave because he's wanted by the police. And this is a real hassle, and it's all going to come to a head soon.
God, they've all got so many problems, haven't they?
Oh, they do. Yeah. And the rest of the team is sitting around watching a giant, pretty giant TV. Not, not as big as the monitors back in the day.
No, but, you know, still good though.
Impressive for a TV in the late 80s.
Mm, yeah.
I hate these conversations that they have where Cliff is talking about music today. He's talking about it's not like Miles Davis or Louis Armstrong. And I think, Cliff, you're not 120. Anyway, yeah, and Rhea's talking about how she likes country music. And Scott's just saying he likes everything because that's the type of guy he is. He just likes to get along with everyone. Anyway, this conversation is so boring that Cliff starts to look at the paper in the middle of it and goes, "Whoa, Gargwax!" and runs out and says, "Get suited up, we're going places."
Wow.
So pretty soon the Doom Patrol are at a military base in Arizona because somehow they know it's going to get attacked next. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to convince a cliche of a general what's coming. And he's huffing and blustering like he's a caricature. Anyway, they say they know what's coming. So and the team on assembled are Wayne, Karma, Cliff, Robot Man, Val, a Negative Woman, Rhea, what's her name? Lodestone, mm-hmm. and Scott Fisher, no code name.
He's a rebel, man. He's
yeah. Anyway, there's a whole page trying to convince this guy that they know what's coming and robots, aliens, all this sort of stuff. When suddenly they're gratified to see that the Plastic Men are actually descending on the base and it's time to fight.
Yeah, there's a pretty cool shot of all the Plastic Men coming back down and attacking the team. And one of them kind of grabs the entirety of Rhea's head with his fist.
Yep.
Which just is kind of scary, the size of him. Yeah.
They're tussling. And all the Plastic Men are kind of naked, yes. Fair to say.
Yes.
There's some strategically placed shadow. You can't see any plastic junk or anything. But
I think it's fair to say, though, that they wouldn't really be anatomically correct in that area.
No.
Unless Gargawax is really kinky.
Well, the Doom Patrol was not a mature reader's book at this point.
Not at this point. Oh, God, can you imagine if Morrison did the Plastic Men? Holy shit. Sorry, as you were.
All right, so the team immediately spring into action to repel the Plastic Men in a way that doesn't work particularly well. So Negative Woman is zooming around and saying that they've been synthesized to resist her negative energy. Perhaps I can be more useful in my physical form.
Hmm.
Scott he's actually having some luck because his super hot touch can melt them in seconds because they're made of plastic.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the blue ones, which are the strongest ones, so we seem to have three modes. They've got the pink ones, which are really hot, I think. They melt things. And then the blue ones are really strong. What do the yellow ones do? I can't remember.
I think the yellow ones could stretch.
Oh, yeah, they're a bit elastic.
I think yeah. That was their power, because they've got the elongated necks almost and seem a bit more slimmer than the other two types of Plastic Men.
Yeah. So then we come to a double page spread of the team fighting. So that's what have we got? We've had two full page spreads and now a double page spread in this comic. So this is one of the quicker ones to draw. Yeah, and you see that Karma's copying it. So Wayne is actually getting punched in the face a bit because these Plastic Men do not succumb to his powers, which makes people or, you know, sentient beings miss him. Then we see a quarter of a million miles away on the far side of the moon. We see that Gargarex's spaceship or base, it kind of looks like a floating city thing.
Mm.
And I'm gratified to see this is the classic design, really, pretty much from the 60s, just carried straight over.
Very cool, yeah. And Gargawax, even though he's this gigantic, gross dude, he looks awesome.
Yeah. Eric Larson really exaggerates Gargawax, so he's like about five times bigger than we've ever seen him before.
Yes.
And he's got a great big wine glass in his hand and all these alien servers are bringing him plates and trays of food.
Mm.
Yeah, he's getting ready to destroy the Earth or take it over or something. He talks about how he destroyed his own planet. So that's something that's happened since we saw him in the 60s.
Mm.
He's been away and tested weapons there and killed lots of people. basically destroyed his whole planet. So now he wants to take over Earth. And there's a bit of vengeance in there. He's petty.
Yeah, just a bit.
Yeah, and he's got bare feet. Interesting. In his great big purple moo-moo. So the Doom Patrol are still fighting. And Val is now punching and kicking just as Val, giving up on using the negative energy. Scott is—he's really cutting through them like butter. So he's, you know, he's
literally
karate
yeah.
chop straight through them, or is it a judo chop? I'm not sure. It could be a judo chop.
Let's call it a judo chop. Sure.
Judo chop.
Yeah.
Wayne has had a gutful. He's got bruises on his face and a black eye, and he's kind of fed up. But then the plastic men get all the missiles, and then they all retreat. But they try and grab Robot Man as they're going. So the blue ones have all got Robot Man. And the team are struggling to hold on to Robot Man. So they've got one arm, one leg. And he's starting to get torn to bits by the beam that's lifting him up and these blue plastic men that will not let go. But Lodestone, she ends up between... she grabs both hands of Glyph and the rest of the team grab her legs. And then she uses her magnetic power. She tries to pull him down, but he starts tearing him apart. Then she just creates magnetic interference with the beam, which is pretty clever. And that means that Glyph is released, even though his lower torso, or his lower body gets ripped in half and taken with them.
Everyone take a drink.
And Glyph is, he's not very happy with the way his body's gone.
Yeah.
He said this is the second time it's malfunctioned. It malfunctioned when he fought shrapnel, something I didn't even notice at the time. But he's got replacement parts by the crate full at, back at the base.
Of course.
And he gets them on, and he's talking about how it sucks being made of metal, and he wished he was flesh and blood. And then he's telling this to Scott, who's going, yeah, I guess so. But he's inside he's going, but you ask me my real choice, you might be real surprised.
Oh, Scott. God.
Scott. What's going on with Scott? There's something there. We'll find that out later. I'm sure he's going to live long and prosper.
Hey, spoilers.
And Wayne feels useless. He's sitting at the bar. He's sad. He's just a punching bag. Rhea comes up to cheer him up, and, you know, naturally his issues, he pushes her away, and she calls him a jerk.
God.
Yeah. Val goes to see Joshua. He's had a nap.
Maybe he was just, you know, building up his strength for when the team got back and would need his medical expertise or something. Maybe. But yeah, he's just woken up from a nap.
Yeah. But she's saying, I can't find Larry anywhere. And he says, oh, have you checked the computer lab? And she's going, yep, in his room, and I'm worried about him. I can't but feel responsible. Well, you do have the negative energy, and he doesn't. He's kind of bitter about that. Then we see that Larry is actually at the airport in his wheelchair, and he'd like a ticket one way to Louisiana. Dun, dun, dun.
Wow.
I don't know why he's going to Louisiana.
Nor do I.
Okay, so that's the end of that story. What do we think, Mike?
I have mixed feelings about this story. I think I'll start with the art, because to me, reading this one again, the more I see of Eric Larson's art on the Patrol, the less I like it.
Oh, really? I have the opposite effect.
I do like some of the big splash pages, like when the plastic men are coming down and fighting the team. That was cool. The big double page spread towards the back of the book where the fight's just getting more and more insane, and when Wayne's getting smacked out by one of the pink plastic men, that was cool. But a lot of it, it's okay. But like Robot Man, he looks too skinny. It looks like he needs to eat more or something. He's just like a skinny robot, and I just
he's got a big steam shovel jaw. I mean, I actually like the Eric Larson art. Whenever he does an action scene, I always find it's really dynamic. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
But I remember not liking it when these came out. The change from Lytle to this disturbed me. But I guess when you look back and you know, oh, this is only going to be, you know, 16 or so issues like this,
mm.
you know, you get used to it.
Yeah.
And I there's something kind of goofy about it.
I'll it's agree on cool. that, yes. Like Scott's big puppy dog eyes as Cliff is moaning about his life. You think, oh, God. And that was the other thing. The level of mopiness within the team is just...
Oh, it's over the top.
It's grating.
They are such a miserable team. And, you know, they're not... like. Classic Doom Patrol are all misfits and they're misunderstood, whereas these people, they're just all miserable.
That's right. I mean, even in, like, Volume 1 by Drake and Premiani, you know, they complained about their lot in life then, but there was still a certain charm about them being miserable together as a team.
Yeah.
And same when Morrison and Case took over, and pretty much in every iteration other than this team, they were just so miserable and there was... sort of no light at the end of the tunnel, which yeah. I know sounds odd when comparing it to Morrison's version of the team in the same way, because, man, there was some miserable stuff in that team as well. But there was still a certain charm about the way they were just united in this.
Yeah.
And in this, they're so busy, and this goes on for several issues where they're always just bickering or fighting, and the citizens of Kansas City at the front of the headquarters picketing them probably doesn't help as well.
Yeah. And they really lack for any sort of inspirational leadership in this incarnation, yeah. don't they?
Yeah, Arani is not a great leader.
Yeah, and many of the team are there despite Arani, not because of Arani.
Yeah.
Like it's the young new ones who she recruits, but she does nothing to inspire them or lead them or motivate them.
Not really, no.
Yeah, and no. You know, a lot of them are there. They end up there sort of out of loyalty to the rest of the team, like Cliff and Val.
Mm.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a bit of a shambles. A
little bit, yeah. But this issue, yeah, it was okay. It's not one of my favourite ones, but it had its moments. So it was cool seeing Gargoax and his floating space fortress again.
Yeah, Gargoax right, is. You can't take him seriously. He's kind of. He's just a great big. Obese alien,
yeah.
With typical, you know, with very primal, you know, conquering type needs.
Yeah,
he's not complex.
No, not really. No, so it was good to see him again. So yeah, the issue itself, it's okay. Not one of my favourites, but you know, it'll do.
So there's a bonus book. Bonus book number 3. So these were running through other titles at the same time?
Yes. They were a way to sort of introduce up-and-coming artists and writers into DC books at the time. And the bonus story in this is called A Life in the Day. It was written by Steve Miller with Randy DeBerk.
From the band? From the Steve Miller band, do you think?
I kind of doubt it.
Oh.
No, for you, we'll say it is Steve Miller from the Steve Miller Band. This was just a side venture for him. Yeah, because he kept on rocking it, baby, or something. So, was that Steve Miller, or did I just get my bad 80s music?
No, you
wrong?
Got the right, yeah. No, he did the Joker and all that. And
there we go.
My wife, you know, the big old jet airliner? That's
right. Okay.
Yeah. My wife always thought that song was called Big Old Jed with the Light On.
Right. She might have been a bit wrong. So yes, this bonus story was written by Steve Miller, also the rock star Steve Miller, apparently, with Randy DeBerk on pencils, with Joe Aladetta on the inks. Tim Harkins was the letterer. Elizabeth Kessler did the colours. Paul Kupperberg edited it, interestingly enough. And Mike Gold was the consulting editor. Now, the first thing that struck me about this story was the art style reminded me so much of Steve Lytle's stuff. I really, really enjoyed the art in this. And I realized that we'd seen Randy DeBerk's art in another issue that we've already looked at, which turned out to be Annual Number 1, the bonus story in that. Yep. Which we looked at back in episode 27 when we looked at all the annuals. And it was, yeah, Rhea's backup story in that, which the art in that didn't grab me quite as much.
I remember Randy DeBerg. He got quite good in a very. He's very stylistic. He did a bit of stuff with Dark Stars and the Will Payton Starman. He did some covers there.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if he did some Firestorm. I vaguely remember him being connected with a few characters like that. So, but certainly he sort of tracked around a bit in the 80s after this, but I don't think he ever settled with an ongoing.
Well, he did do quite a bit of work on a Black Canary, a couple of stories in Action Comics Weekly in that period as well, sort of late 80s, early 90s. So it looks like he did a fair bit of stuff for DC. But this was written and drawn before the rear backup story in the annual. So I'm not quite sure what changed with his art between this issue and that one, because it was only a few months, if I remember correctly, between them. Mm. But anyway, as for the story itself, it follows the current team leader, Arani, around Kansas City one day. She's, of course, missing Niles, her husband. What a surprise.
Oh. And she's never mentioned that before.
No, it's quite different for Arani. So she's at a war memorial, you know, lamenting the missing husband, Niles. She meets an elderly woman in a wheelchair. Her name is Ellen, and Ellen is there to pay her respects to her husband, who just passed away. And Ellen seems quite determined that today is the day that she is going to die as well, and she's going to enjoy her last day as much as she can. So wow. What does she do? She drags Arani along to a local diner to have a pork sandwich, even though Arani doesn't really eat meat. And Ellen says to her, just... sit down, shut up, enjoy your pork sandwich. So then what do they do next? They go to a baseball game. They watch the Kansas City Royals playing a game. And it turns out that the player that they mention in it, George Brett, was an actual Kansas City Royal baseball player.
Mm.
Who apparently played for 20 years.
Good golly.
Yeah.
He's tired.
Yes, 20 years straight he played. So, of course, the Kansas City Royals win their game. George Brett hits the ball out of the park. Someone catches the ball and actually offers it up to Ellen. She goes and gets it signed by George. All the while, Arani's saying, why are you doing all this stuff? You think you're going to die today. What are you doing? And Ellen keeps saying to her, I just want to enjoy my last day. You know, you've got to occasionally stop and enjoy your life. And she says, I just want to take you to one last place. And as they're heading there, they come across some fire engines racing to a burning building. And Ellen is saying, well, you know, I know you're in the Doom Patrol. Aren't you going to use your powers to help these people? And of course, Arani says, no, I don't want to get involved. You know, it's not my mission. So Ellen shames her into being a bit useless. And Arani uses her powers to, we don't actually see it, but she sends a spiral of ice up to the top of the burning building, and we assume that she's helped put out the fire. And Ellen says, well, you've got to go speak to the authorities now that you've helped them. And Arani's very reluctant, she doesn't want to get involved. And sure enough, it seems her concern was that she was going to have to answer the same questions she does every time, like, you know, why has the Doom Patrol come to Kansas City? Who are you? You know, are you planning to make reparations to the city for the damaged property? Because it's clearly her fault. My favorite is, are you romantically involved with Robot Man? It's like, no. So even though she hated having to go through that, she feels kind of better for pitching in and helping, which pleases the elderly woman, Ellen. And they make it to their last stop of the day, which is just a park with a fountain and people are playing in the park as the sun sets. And it's here that Ellen says, this is where I want to go. This is a peaceful place for me. And Ellen passes away. And Arani kind of freaks out a little bit. And she says, I should go get a doctor or something. And then she remembers that Ellen said, no, just leave me here, leave me be. So Arani kisses her on the forehead and goes back to the headquarters. She bumps into Cliff, who's just sitting in front of some giant monitors there, doing nothing. And Arani offers him the baseball that Ellen gifted to her. And Cliff sees the autograph on the ball and it says, you know, to Ellen. And Cliff's like, who's this? Who's this Ellen person? And why are you giving it to me? Arani just says, you know, it's a long story, but I thought you might like it. I thought you might want something nice, and you're welcome, my friend. So the story ends there with Arani with a tear running down her cheek, and you kind of think she may have learned a lesson from Ellen to, you know, stop and smell the roses and maybe be nice to her teammates and, you know, enjoy life when she can. But I don't think it'll stick. It's just knowing Arani's obsession with her quote-unquote mission to find her husband, yeah, I don't think Ellen's lesson will stick much at all.
No. And that's a pity. I mean, because really the Doom Patrol in this incarnation have very superficial characterizations. And this is sort of like the one biggest effort to explore anyone's, you know, real personality.
Yeah.
And it's such a somber story. Like, if you had a shot at the Doom Patrol, this would be the last thing I would want to write. You know what I mean? I'd want to do something crazy and, you know, the sort of thing you can only do in comics, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if Ellen turned out to be Monsieur Mallard halfway through the story, this would make it all worthwhile.
Or if she was Giacomo, even better, you know?
Yeah.
We haven't seen him in, what, 20-something years? So,
yeah. Or if the baseball was, a bomb.
A bomb, yeah.
Something.
Of course. But it's interesting that you say that because of the two stories in this issue, I much prefer this one.
Yeah.
But because you're right, it shows an effort to, you know, give Arani a bit more character depth and give her a chance to for her character to grow and deal with something outside of all the bizarreness. And I love the art in this story too, because it to me it's like that classic DC Comics realism from the 80s, which is something, you know, I was a kid when I was getting into comics in the 80s, and the look of this to me, even though some of the panels are very bare and might only have one person in them, just the style of it and the coloring and the way the panels are done, it screams, you know, classic 80s DC comics to me. And I think that's what I really love about it as well, more so than Larson's art. So,
yeah. And,
well,
I mean, worth noting that the design of Robot Man is, again, very, very skinny in this. Very svelte.
Well, yeah, but at least he doesn't have that offset by the gigantic idiot-looking jaw. Sorry. I much prefer the art and the story in general in this compared to the main one in the book, but... Yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was really cool. But yeah, it's a nice note for Arani, but that's all it becomes, a note that doesn't go any further ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So overall, this issue, not a high point in Doom Patrol history.
No. It's an interesting one. We get Gargoax back, which is great.
It's not offensive.
No.
There's no nothing John Byrne did in this one.
Oh, God. Give it time. We'll get back to John Byrne. Give it time. But yeah, overall, it's an okay issue. It's an okay issue. I think we each prefer the different stories for different reasons, which is cool. I'm just disappointed that the Arani story never goes any further, and it's just the one note. Yeah.
Yeah. She has no arc in the whole Kupperberg run, really. There's no character change at all. She starts off one way and finishes one way.
I mean, it's great that she's that committed to finding Niles, but it gets a bit grating after a while when that's another one note for Arani, and that's it. That's all she's concerned about. It gets a bit boring after, 18 issues? Something like that.
Doomsplaining done?
I think so.
Okay. Let's move on to the mailbag of doom.
Sorry.
This week In the Mailbag of Doom, we're getting the answers to the question, what is the best comic cover logo design? So, we only got a handful of answers, which is good, because we can do that quickly.
So I think it may have also been a tough question, too.
Yeah. I don't know. I just don't think people apply themselves. I think, you know, the quality of listeners we've got at the moment is pretty substandard.
Wow.
Anyway. Don't Tearing hand me. It to them, Mike.
Okay. Is this a whole treat them mean, keep them keen sort of thing?
They get what they deserve. Anyway, we heard from Aaron Long, who is at Juice005 and is also a troll, and he's at X Factor number 221. So, is that a serious answer? I will Google it right now.
I think it is. It's a lot more of a...
Is it?
A lot more of a recent logo design than I would have expected. But yeah, it's a cool looking one. And I'm guessing that that's a favorite issue of Aaron's. But yeah.
Did it have a unique design for that 221? Or was he just pulling one from the air?
I'm not sure the logic behind the logo design, but it may have been like a logo
it.
Change.
Oh, it's got an X with a... looks like a person standing in the X.
I think it was kind of unique amongst the other X logos at the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's a non-troll answer for a change from Aaron.
Could this be? Really?
I'm going to say yes. And I think everyone should have a bonus drink for that very reason. We also heard from Chemozoid. At
Chemozoid.
God, I pronounced that as well as he did. It's Doug Zawisa, going by the Twitter handle of Chemozoid, or Zoid, or Chemozoid. At
Zoid.
Yeah, that thing, the killer bunny rabbits, at D Zawisa. And he said, the Swamp Thing logo from the first volume, still a classic. And he thanked Dalby for blog.com for the pic. And yeah, it's the really cool old Swamp Thing logo that just looks creepy and swampy and has a really cool shading at the bottom of each of the letters. That was,
yeah,
that was
I like
cool.
How all the letters are a bit dirty on the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've been sitting cool. In the swamp.
Hmm.
Yeah. We have Moby One, who's at Shmoby One, and he said, it's often fun when the cover artist incorporates the title into the cover design. And he displayed two Flash issues. So we had Flash 174, which has all the rogues perched on a great big Flash sign, sink a bit like the Hollywood sign, except it says Flash.
Yes.
And in front of them is a very beaten down Flash lying there, and they're all perched above him, gloating. And interesting to note, this cover was recycled for Secret Origins when they did the Rogues issue.
Okay. So,
just a little fun fact there. And the other one was the Flash 181, which was in the 2000s in the Geoff Johns era, where it's got the Flash running around a corner on a road which has the Flash written on it in great big letters. And that was from a month where all the DC titles had the unique cover designs to incorporate the title of the comic into them.
Cool.
So that's a sweet one.
Mm. We heard from Ange at Dr. Ange 70.
Hey, Dr. Ange.
He said, partial to the Spectres. Also like Shade the Changing Man with the crazy fonts. And he provided us with a cover for the Spectre number 440, which is very old school looking. And the logo there looks very spectral and kind of wibbly wobbly around the edges. Very
Made
creepy
of
looking.
Smoke, sort of.
Yeah.
Just a point of order, that's Adventure Comics 440.
I do apologize. Yes, Adventure Comics presents the Spectre. There we go. Goddamn titles all changing. And Shade the Changing Man, number one, which is an insane-looking cover to begin with, but the logo itself with Shade in big white letters and then changing all in bizarre colors and different fonts for each letter. It's awesome fun. Yeah.
It's like a ransom note from a classic film. A little bit. Yes, and finally we heard from Ostrakus One, whose Hacker Time went vile at the moment. And he showed us an issue of Batman number 366 from 1983, which has the Joker and Batman tussling on top of a building. And the Batman logo is sort of incorporated into the side of the building that they're fighting on.
Kind of like, I'm not sure if it's meant to be like the way it's lit or graffiti or what, but it looks cool. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I'm not sure whether it kind of looks like a bit of a projection, but
yeah.
It's a cool cover, and it really focuses the comic in a different way. And it, at the top, it says the Joker is wild.
Yeah,
and he does look wild.
That's a really evil, cool grin on the Joker on this cover too.
And it looks like a Walt Simonson cover to me. Yes, I'm going to say it's a Walt Simonson cover, and you've got to love Walt Simonson.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the law.
Okay.
Mike, have you got an answer?
I'm going to cheat a little bit and just say the Detective Comics logo and all the way it's changed over the many years it was running in Volume 1. How it started off, you know, very simple, and then as you got further into its run, they, you know, did things like incorporating a bat into the V, or then, you know, having an actual bat in the background, or having big bold letters around the time that the first Batman film came out. Just the way that it's changed over the decades, I find really interesting and part of the appeal. And then in the sort of 90s and 2000s, when the logo went back to a very classic, sleek, simple design that harked back to the original run as well. Just really cool. You can tell I'm reading all Detective Comics at the moment too. So I'm sort of always checking out which way the logo has slightly changed as I'm moving between different decades. It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Okay. Well, fun fact about that, they, you know how they use a bat? Originally they tried a giraffe and they weren't very happy with the results. So they went back to the bat after a little while.
Why on earth would they try to use a giraffe?
I don't know. It was just what was going on at the time.
Was Haney involved?
This story may not be true.
Right. We'll Google it later. Yeah, for sure. What about you, Paul? What's a fave logo of yours?
Well, I'm going to pick a comic that no one has said the name of aloud for probably about 12 years. And it's called The Chain Gang War. So if you go to your Twitter feed, I've sent you a DM of the cover of number one.
Okay, I will do that now, live on the air.
This is amazing. Live Twitter interaction between
It's two so hosts. Interactive for so many people. Let's have a look. Okay, I very vaguely recall this comic.
Yeah, so this was a comic from the 90s? I'm going to say
91.
Yeah, I think it's about 91. So, yeah, this was the same time as sort of Nightfall, when you had Azbats, Azrael as Batman. So, this cover, it has very, very bold words, chain gang, and then war is written on like graffiti. And they incorporated a piece of chain which ran down the side of every spine. Really bold. And it was a really underrated book by John Wagner, I think, and Dave Johnson. Dave Johnson, who only does covers these days. So, he did a lot of internal art in this book. And it's a pretty awesome comic. Yeah, so I really liked the cover, the logo of that. And they don't do them like that anymore.
No.
I was gonna say.
No, they don't.
And it lent itself, they did a lot of chromium on that cover design. I think they did like three issues where they put a bit of chrome on it.
Right.
Just on the logo. So if anyone remembers that, I'm happy to chat about that with you sometime.
Okay. I have a very vague recollection of this one. I don't remember the title, but the image. Yeah. Did it run for very long?
12 issues.
Right.
I had three letters in it.
Wow. Well done.
And that's a tip for people. If you want to get your letters published, write to a book that no one cares about.
If only comics still did letters pages these days. Now it's all chat rooms and message boards and DMs and
Snapchats,
you know, tweets. You young people today have got it so easy.
Yeah. Know?
Uh-oh, we're sounding old again. People are going to start drinking. Well, on that note, we will sign off for this week. As always, you can contact us on Twitter at WFDpod. You can email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can also contact us on the Waiting for Doom Facebook page and Tumblr page as well. So, Paul, what will we be discussing on next week's show?
We're going to talk about the Doom Patrol Volume 2. We're going to leap ahead a little bit to issues number 39 and 40, which is the next two issues of Grant Morrison's run that we're up to, where we continue their adventure in space.
Excellent.
So they were lost in space, and now we see what happens next. And I've also got a question of the week for next week, and it is, what comic series would make a great video game? So put your thinking caps on and come up with an answer for that one. Do you think it's a hard question this time?
No, it's an easy question. Well, okay.
Maybe.
So you could have different types of video games. Oh, okay, I'll think about it some more and get back to you.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Paul. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We will catch you again next time on Waiting for Doom.
The Doom Patrol podcast, where we wait
for Doom. See you guys.
Bye.